Okay, let's jump right in. There's this central irony in material science that's just fascinating. We spend, billions of dollars engineering the absolute strongest structures you can imagine, pipelines, bridges, you name it, and we build them out of iron.
Specifically, iron 56, the
Yeah.
most stable element in the universe, chemically speaking.
Exactly. It's the anchor of the whole periodic table. It should be invincible.
It's the heavyweight champion. Thermodynamically, you just can't get more stable.
And yet all of that stability can be brought to its knees by, well, the lightest, smallest thing in existence,
A single proton.
a single proton. So today we're doing a deep dive into the technical fundamentals of hydrogen science, and we are laser focused on Chapter 11.
This chapter it's dense, but it's brilliant. It's less of a chemistry lesson and more like a tactical analysis of a siege.
A siege, I like that.
Yeah, we're looking at how hydrogen gets into the steel lattice, the torturous paths it takes, and this really weird paradox where making steel stronger.
Actually makes it weaker, or at least more likely to fail.
More susceptible, exactly. It's a David and Goliath story.
Except David gets inside Goliath's bloodstream and makes him explode. But before the destruction, we should probably set the stage, because for a very long time, we didn't even know this enemy existed.
Right. You have to go back to the mid-18th century. The whole scientific map was different. We're talking about Henry Cavendish around 1766.
He called it fictitious air,
It
which is just a great name.
is a great name. He was, dissolving metals in acid, zinc, iron, and he sees this gas bubbling up. But the real breakthrough is when he tried to burn it.
And he found that burning this fictitious air produced water.
Just water.
And we have to pause here, because to us, that sounds so simple. Hydrogen plus oxygen, you get water. It's basic chemistry.
But in 1766, that just shattered their whole worldview. You have to remember, they were basically running on Aristotle's software.
The four elements: earth, air, fire, and water.
And for 2,000 years, the consensus was that water was elementary, an indivisible building block of reality.
And Cavendish just comes along and proves it's a compound. You can make it.
Exactly. It completely broke that Aristotelian model. Lavoisier later gives it the name hydrogen, literally water former. And it really kicks off our modern understanding of chemical
But
reactions.
here's the pivot for our deep dive. Cavendish made hydrogen by reacting metal with acid.
And today, in modern industry, that exact reaction is what we're terrified of.
Because that reaction is the Trojan horse. And the source makes this critical distinction, one I think a lot of people miss: the huge difference between hydrogen gas in a tank and the hydrogen that actually cracks a pipeline.
It's H2 versus H, molecular versus atomic hydrogen.
Right, so H2, molecular hydrogen, that's the gas, two atoms bonded together.
And that bond is incredibly strong. At, say, room temperature and normal pressure, molecular hydrogen is basically inert when it comes to steel. It just bounces off the walls of the tank.
Too fat to get inside the iron lattice.
That's a good way to put it. The text says the dissociation rate at room temperature is something like 10 to the minus 36.
So, statistically zero.
Right, it's zero. The ghost can't get into the machine in its gas form. The energy barrier is just way too high for the molecule to split on its own.
So the invasion needs a catalyst. The molecule has to be split before it can get in.
Precisely. The entry point is almost always a chemical reaction happening on the surface of the steel,
Like rust.
like rust, corrosion, or some other electrochemical process. That reaction generates individual hydrogen atoms, single protons, right there on the metal skin.
And a single proton is small enough to slip through.
It's the smallest thing there is. It just slips right between the iron atoms. So yeah, the pristine gas tank is fine. It's the corroding pipe that's soaking up the enemy.
Okay, so the ghost is in the machine. Atomic hydrogen is inside the steel. Now, this is where the source material gets really, really interesting. It stops treating steel like a solid block.
And starts describing it as a landscape, a maze.
And to get the maze, we have to talk about perlite.
Perlite sounds like a gemstone.
It does, but it's actually the most common microstructure in carbon steel.
Right. It's called that because it has this iridescent mother-of-pearl look under a microscope. But if you zoom way in, structurally, it's basically a layer cake.
Alternating layers of two totally different things.
Ferrite and cementite.
Okay, so ferrite is.
Ferrite is basically pure iron. It's soft, it's ductile.
And cementite.
That's iron carbide, Fe3C. It's hard, brittle, almost like a ceramic.
So for a tiny hydrogen atom trying to get through this,
Yeah.
those two layers are completely different terrain.
Oh, completely. The ferrite is a superhighway. The iron atoms are arranged in a way that leaves these little gaps, and the energy it takes for hydrogen to jump between them is really low, so it just zips through the ferrite.
But then it smacks into the cementite.
It hits a wall. The diffusion barrier in cementite is an order of magnitude higher.
And why is that? Is it just denser?
It's the carbon. The carbon atoms in the cementite structure are physically blocking the little channels that the hydrogen wants to use, so it just can't get through. It bounces off.
And this brings up a concept in the chapter that I thought was just great, tortuosity.
It's a fantastic engineering term. It's a measure of how twisted and convoluted a path is.
So because the hydrogen can't go through the cementite, it has to go around.
It has to find a gap at the edge of the layer and wind its way through. It's not a straight line at all.
So its actual travel distance is much longer.
Much longer. In a fully pyrolytic steel, the path length increases by a factor of about 30.
Wow. 30 times longer.
30 times. So that high tortuosity factor is actually a good thing from a defensive standpoint. It slows the invasion way down.
It turns a sprint into a marathon through a labyrinth.
Exactly. But it also creates traps. The microstructure isn't perfect. It's full of defects, grain boundaries, dislocations, the interfaces between the layers.
Potholes in the highway?
Perfect analogy. The hydrogen atom falls into one of these traps, a little energy well, and gets stuck.
And that can be good or bad?
It depends. If it's a deep trap, an irreversible trap, that's great. The hydrogen is locked away and can't cause any trouble. But if it's a shallow, reversible trap, a little bit of heat or stress can knock it loose.
And then you have a ticking time bomb.
You do. You have this reservoir of hydrogen ready to move to a crack tip.
But engineers can actually manipulate this maze. The source talks about spheroidization.
Right. This is a classic heat treatment. You take that perlite layer kick and you just hold it at a high temperature for a while.
And the layers, they ball up.
Surface tension takes over.
Yeah.
The flat plates of cementite want to minimize their surface area, so they pull themselves into little spheres. The layer cake becomes a chocolate chip cookie.
Which geometrically changes everything for the hydrogen.
Drastically. You've gotten rid of the continuous walls. Hydrogen can flow much faster now, but you've also massively reduced the total interface area where it gets trapped. The steel just holds less hydrogen overall.
It's amazing you can control an invisible gas by changing the shape of microscopic crystals.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about when the manufacturing process goes wrong. The source brings up a huge industrial headache called banding.
Banding, the bane of pipeline engineers. So we just talked about that nice uniform perlite layer cake.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes when the steel is cooling down in the mill, the ingredients don't mix perfectly. Things like manganese tend to segregate.
So you get stripes instead of uniform mix.
You get distinct bands, a wide band of pure ferrite, then a band of perlite, and so on.
And that creates something called anisotropy.
Which just means the properties are different depending on the direction. And for hydrogen, those ferrite bands are now dedicated superhighways.
Oh, I see. So it can just race down those bands.
It races through the material much faster than you'd expect, and the cracking happens right along the edges of those bands. The steel just splits apart like pages in a book.
So how do you stop that?
You have to be fast. The fix is accelerated cooling. You cool the steel so quickly from the melt that the atoms literally don't have time to move around and segregate.
You freeze the structure in place before the bands can form.
You beat the diffusion clock.
There was another process in the source that seems so counterintuitive. Pickling.
Pickling. The original sin of wire manufacturing, you could say.
Because we're using acid to clean the steel, but we just established that acid plus metal is how the hydrogen gets in the first place.
That's the catch-22. To make high-strength wire, you have to get all the oxide scale off the surface. And the best way to do that is to dip it in a big vat of acid.
Which cleans it perfectly.
It does, but it also turns the entire surface of the wire into a hydrogen generator. That reaction is pumping atomic hydrogen right into the steel.
And this is actually how they first discovered hydrogen embrittlement, isn't it?
Johnson, 1875. He was working with iron wire and noticed that before the acid bath, it was tough. After the bath, it snapped like a twig.
So how do we still use this process today without everything breaking?
The solution is actually pretty low tech. You bake it.
You just put it in an oven?
Pretty much. They bake the wire at about 150 degrees Celsius. It's just enough heat to give the trapped hydrogen atoms the energy they need to wiggle free and diffuse out.
You're letting them find the exit.
You're essentially burping the steel.
But the scary part is what happens if you don't do it right. The source called it delayed spontaneous fracture.
And that's the nightmare. You pickle the wire, you don't bake it properly, you ship it out, it gets installed, put under tension, everything looks fine.
But inside, The hydrogen is slowly moving.
It's always moving toward the areas of highest stress. And then 2 weeks later, snap, no warning, catastrophic failure.
Which leads us to the strength paradox. And this was the part of the deep dive where I really had to stop and reread. The general rule is the stronger the steel, the more susceptible it is to hydrogen.
It sort of hurts your brain, doesn't it? You would think stronger means more resistant. But with hydrogen embrittlement, strength is a liability.
Why? What's the mechanism there?
It's all about stress. High-strength steels are designed to hold incredible loads, which means they exist under very high internal tension. And that tension creates what's called hydrostatic stress.
And hydrogen is attracted to that stress.
It's driven by it. The stress actually expands the iron lattice just a tiny bit, making the gaps bigger. The hydrogen flows towards those expanded gaps like water flowing downhill. It concentrates right at the crack tips where the stress is highest.
So a stronger steel is like a stronger magnet for the hydrogen.
That's a perfect way to describe it. It concentrates the enemy at the most vulnerable point, lowers the energy needed to break the iron bonds, and the crack propagates.
So here's the problem. We need incredibly strong steel for things like suspension bridge cables. But that strength makes them vulnerable. Is there a way around this?
There is, and it brings us right back to perlite. But this time, a really abused version of it. We're talking about cold-drawn wire.
This is the deformed perlite.
Yes. They take that perlite structure and just pull it, stretch it through a series of dies until it's incredibly thin and incredibly strong.
And that stretching process physically rearranges the microstructure.
It elongates everything. Those layers of ferrite and cementite get stretched out and perfectly aligned with the length of the wire. The source uses a wood grain analogy, which is perfect.
Right. It's hard to snap a log across the grain, but easy to split it along the grain.
Exactly that. Drawn perlite is ridiculously strong, but because of this wood grain structure, it behaves completely differently when hydrogen attacks.
So what happens? The hydrogen gets in, a crack starts.
But the crack can't go across the wire. The microstructure, those long aligned layers, forces the crack to turn 90 degrees and run along the length of the wire.
That delaminates.
It delaminates. It splits like a log instead of snapping like a carrot.
Now, splitting doesn't sound good.
But in this case, it's a survival mechanism. If the wire snaps, the bridge fails. But if it delaminates lengthwise, it can still hold the load.
So it relieves the local stress without a catastrophic break.
It's a fail-safe built right into the atomic architecture. We're using that anisotropy, that directionality, as a defense mechanism. It's brilliant.
It just shows that material science is so much more than just chemistry. It's architecture. It's about arranging the room.
Absolutely. We can't change the elements, but we can build a maze to trap the intruder or align the walls so that when they break in a safe way.
And we have to, because hydrogen is just everywhere.
It's everywhere, and the battle never really stops. There was one last detail in the text about aging the drawn wire. After all that processing, they still let it sit at a mild temperature, about 100 C, just to let the last bits of weakly trapped hydrogen sneak out.
That was the detail that really stuck with me. After all of that, there's still gas trapped inside. It just makes you look at a suspension bridge differently. It makes you wonder how much atomic hydrogen is just holding its breath inside those cables right now.
That's the question that keeps metallurgists up at night. We can build the maze, but the mouse is very, very small and very persistent.
Just waiting for the right conditions to migrate to a crack tip.
Check your tire cords, everyone.
On that comforting note, that's our deep dive on the Tiny Destroyer. We'll see you on the next one.